The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
It's wonderful to be sitting with you here this morning with this beautiful, soft, warm light filtering into the Zendo, and it has that poignancy that light sometimes has before a storm, before our evening storm. And part of me just wants to end there. And the other part is aware that we are working and sitting and practicing with the Tibetan Lojong teachings, especially as Zen teacher Norman Fisher has helpfully interpreted them for a Zen audience. And we have lots more to do. And today I thought I would talk about two of them that the commentators seem to agree are corollaries. That's Norm Fisher's term. They go together. And the first is the kind of dour-sounding abandon hope, number 28, and the second is, don't poison yourself. So kind of a little gothic twist on our Lojong teachings. And these are within the discipline of relationship, but both of these slogans, abandon hope and don't poison yourself, are about our relationships with ourselves. And so I thought I would start by just saying a little something that applies to both of these slogans, a little something about how we think of the self in Buddhism. And one of the wonderful things about sitting and teaching and practicing with these slogans is that we've gotten to revisit some Buddhist concepts and really think about what they mean in this context. And so I'm going to talk about a very basic Buddhist concept for a bit, which is the concept of no self, or the teaching. Maybe teaching is better because it's not really a concept. The teaching of no self. And no self is very fundamental. It's one of the three marks of existence, something that characterizes all things, including us. And the three marks of existence are suffering, dukkha, and impermanence, anitya, and then no self, anatman. And it struck me for the first time ever this morning that, as they used to say on Sesame Street, and maybe still do, one of these things is not like the other, and you can guess which one this is. So here's how they're a little bit different. The first one, impermanence. Every tradition recognizes this as a mark of existence. In the autumn, the leaves fall down and the days get shorter and the grass withers. And people get older and they die. And, you know, the Bible says all flesh is grass. And so everyone recognizes this, even if we try to live sometimes as though it's not the case. And suffering too, you know, hard to avoid seeing all this suffering in the world. You just have to watch the news for a few days and you seem to be in this just, you know, morass of suffering all over the globe. There's always someplace else where disaster is striking, war, the things that we remind ourselves of in the sutra service, in the dedication. And if you live in a small pre-modern village, then you know everybody's business and you know how much suffering there is just within, you know, the area you can walk to in 15 minutes. And so that one, not really a surprise, but, no self, that's the one I think that doesn't seem to get a lot of press outside of Buddhism, and this is part of Shakyamuni Buddha's great innovation in terms of the traditions he inherited and then built upon, and then decisively changed for us. And so, no self. And notice too that in that when we turn these into English, this is the one we need to make a little compound out of it. There's no word for no self in English. So we take two words and hyphenate them, and we get no self. So no self, not so obvious, because we look around us at the 10,000 things, the myriad dharmas, the all the things that we think are freestanding objects, and that include all the beings, and that include all that ourselves and our thoughts and our emotions. We have names for them. Now I'm feeling fear. No, now I'm. It's more like a terror now. No, now I think I'm just hungry. And we think all these are separate things, and we divide them all up, and we think that they're bounded. And we sometimes are surprised when things slip out of their boundaries and won't stay put. But we shouldn't be surprised, because all these boundaries are just us putting a grid over the flux of experience so that we can understand it better and talk about it better. And it's very, that we're getting back to our very first days here. You know, it's very adaptive, of course. Of course we need rudimentary sense of self and other, and we need to think a lot of the time that we're dealing with stable, separate objects. If the car is hurtling towards you at 70 miles an hour and you don't jump out of the crosswalk, you're thinking, well, there's really no boundary between me and the car. It's not going to help you survive. And so we jump out of the way. And yet, in some ways, there is no boundary between you and the car. And you know, we look at our skin and we think, well, yeah, I'm enclosed in this, what the Buddhist writings sometimes call a skin bag. You know, here I am in my bag of skin. And it's defining the separation mark between me and the world. And then we look again at our skin and we see that it is literally porous. Our word porous comes from this. It's filled with pores. And now we're not so sure, well, maybe it's the skin that connects me to everything else. And we contemplate what the Buddhist tradition calls the nine holes of the body. And yeah, we're not closed systems at all. You know, there was a big vogue in the 17th century for putting birds, poor things, in bell jars, where you could pump out the oxygen and watching them die. And people hadn't really known about oxygen before that. So this was quite a revelation. And yet, this is our lives. We can't live for, you know, a couple of minutes without this constant flow in and out, without this constant interchange with the environment, and our minds made from all kinds of things that we would consider outside, you know, including language. We didn't make those words up, and our notions of who we are. You know, so much of it, little narratives and stories we suck in with our mother's milk and become. And we become acculturated that way. And just in at a more radical level, you know, this sense that, that what we are is, inextricable from everything else and each other dharma, what we sometimes naively consider a separate thing, is we are inextricably part of that. And so no, there is no self. And this applies to things and it applies to us. And yet, the illusion of a stable, separate self is so persistent. And it starts, you know, with the name we're given. We all have a name. And, you know, okay, so now you're Alan. So you go be that separate person and, you know, see what you can do with it. And no wonder. You know, and very useful for our parents. I had four siblings. it would have been a problem if we didn't have different names. But it encouraged us to think that we were all separate, even though we certainly weren't and aren't to this day. And none of us in this room is separate, not one of us, from everyone else in the world and all beings in the universe. So we get pulled back again and again and again into this illusion, though, that we do have a separate self. And so these two slogans are meant to catch us up in some of the things we do when we think that we are separate and permanent and not part of the Tao, not part of the flow. And just now, I've been struck by how not only are these corollaries, but as I looked at a few different commentaries, some said things about one that others said about the other, and vice versa. So these two are not separate and blended each other. So just to give you one example of how they can be differentiated, I'll tell you what Pema Chodron says in her lovely little kind of gift book, Always Maintain a Joyful Mind, that gives you just a little bit about each slogan. So number 28, abandon any hope of fruition, is the way she translates it. And the commentary, the key instruction is to stay in the present. Don't get caught up in hopes of what you'll achieve and how good your situation will be someday in the future. What you do right now is what matters. So abandon any, don't make it about you. And, you know, this is sometimes how this truth of no self is presented to us. It's not about you. And then the second one, don't poison yourself, is in the Tibetan tradition, it's more like don't eat poisonous food. Or she says, abandon poisonous food. And the commentary, you can use these very slogans, I'm adding very, you can use these slogans to build up your ego. For instance, you refrain from talking about others' defects or maligning them, but only so people will praise you. In this way, compassionate teachings designed to lessen your sense of self-centeredness become like rotten food that poisons you and deceives others. So it's not about you, and don't make this practice about you. This practice is supposed to be softening our boundaries, and as we practice, we let the self fall away. So what an irony if we were to use these practices and these teachings to build the self right back up, which is what this illusory self wants. It's like a, we've been talking about viruses. It's like a kind of viral organism, you know, that keeps trying to replicate itself and keeps finding devious ways to do it. Viruses are you can't go and get, or we would all be taking them, a pill to prevent the common cold, because the cold viruses are constantly shifting around. They're much too clever for that. They're a moving target, and so is the illusory self. And so it finds all kinds of ways to remanufacture itself as an illusion. Since some things in our experience keep indicating to us that it's not real. So, what to say about these? I want to go back to abandon hope of fruition. Another way of putting this is some advice that's often given to beginning Zen students that was given to me. Don't think that this is going to make you a better person. Don't come to Zen wanting to be an improved version of yourself. I'm broken and Zen will fix me. I'm inadequate and Zen will give me some of what I need to feel better about myself. Things like that happen, but they're accidents. And we really don't want to get hung up on them, because we'll be very disappointed when we find that we're still the karmic selves that we were before. Not quite the same, thanks to this teaching of impermanence. But there's still a karmic self there. And we all know about gurus and others who think that they have left the karmic self behind. And they get into a lot of trouble and do heinous things that hurt people
out of this illusion that, enlightened being. No danger here. So, and I want to revisit something I said last night. Last night, we were talking about, deal with the biggest problems first. And I said, rightly, I think, that you don't always know what your biggest problems are. And that I thought I had a big problem with anger that turned out to have a lot to do with circumstances that I was no longer in. And so I felt I was able to deal with that, with my anger. And now I want to say, maybe not so fast, because there I was falling into that very illusion. So Zen had helped me. Now, Zen did help me, but let me explain better. My daughter has very sensitive skin, and she has an allergy, for example, to most laundry detergents. And so her skin was, you know, really irritated all the time until we found this out. And then we got her a very special detergent. Even the scentless, etc. ones didn't work for her, but we got her a special one, and the irritation went away. That didn't mean that she no longer had an allergy. She still was allergic. She just wasn't being exposed to it. So if there's an irritant in our life that brings out something in us like anger, and we take the irritant away, then it doesn't mean that we're not angry people anymore. So I still have the same karmic tendencies towards anger, if provoked, as I had before. That's one thing I want to say. So I have abandoned hope of fruition in that area. And let me say something else. And now I'm going to take a step back and remind you of this beautiful thing that Samuel Beckett says about the two thieves that were crucified, one on either side of Christ. And Samuel Beckett says, don't despair. One of the thieves was saved. Don't presume. One of the thieves was damned. And so we've just gone over don't presume, abandon hope of fruition. But don't despair either. Because although we still have these karmic tendencies, we don't have to act as unskillfully, as purely reactively on them as maybe we were acting before we found the practice. And so it doesn't make us better people, but it maybe can facilitate less hurtful behaviors. And if not, why do we spend so much time studying the precepts, which are not rules, but they're kind of, I think of them as guideposts. Couple times when I've been on the Appalachian Trail, up in the mountains, there's just been this dense mist, and you could barely see, you know, anything in front of you, but someone has, knowing that this area gets misty, has helpfully put these guideposts at intervals, and they have, instead of just a little white mark that opposed to you guys, they have kind of a bigger mark, and you can just see it, and you can't stay exactly on the path, but you know now more or less where to head. And that's how I think of the precepts. They're like in this mist of our lives. There are these little guideposts. It's like, okay, if I go that direction, then I won't go so far astray. I won't get turned totally around. And so the precepts help us to create less pain as we go through the world for ourselves and other people. We could say less bad karma. But as we are impelled this way and that by our beginningless habit energies, right? But that doesn't mean that the habit energies just go. You don't get to have total liberation from them. So don't make this about you. Don't think that this will make you special. Don't set yourself up as someone who is different from others. Ma Zhu's The Fruit of the Bodhisattva Way that we read together starts, "You who seek the Dharma should seek nothing." And that's one way that this resonates for me. Seek nothing. And so, abandon poisonous food. This is another way of saying, don't be so obsessed with yourself. And don't make the very practices that are meant to free you from yourself into ways of helping your viral self take root in you again and proliferate and spread. Think that if you pass a koan, some of us do koan work, working with these cryptic little stories that help shake us out of our certainties. Don't think that if you pass a koan, now you're a step further ahead. Doesn't work that way. My experience has been, you start at the beginning every single time. And one of the Japanese teachers who helped establish Zen in America, and who is, you know, stands out for having not ended up being deluded about himself and misbehaving. As far as I can tell, he lived a very exemplary life in America and is a model for us all, Shunryu Suzuki. You know, he called his approach beginner's mind. And so there's a little anecdote about him where in the early years, I think before San Francisco had even moved to it, San Francisco Zen Center had even moved to its present location on Page Street. And one of the American students just really couldn't get a handle on doing Zazen and breath counting, very big in San Francisco when you begin your practice and for a long time afterwards. And so counting from 1 to 10, counting each breath, 1, then 2, up to 10, starting again, 1, 2, and seeing if you get to 15, okay, back to 1. Some people can't make it past 6 or 3. And this young woman was one of those who couldn't get to 10, couldn't do this practice. Very frustrating for her. And she just really gave herself devotedly to this practice because this is what Shunryu Suzuki taught. And she had faith in his teaching. And one day she came in to the interview with the teacher and she was beaming. And she said, Roshi, I counted to 10 again and again and again today. I'm finally doing Zazen. And he reprimanded her. He said, you are not doing Zazen. Never think that. Zazen is doing Zazen. And I love that story. And so when I start to think that my practice is getting somewhere, I start to think, oh, I'm really getting this practice down. I think, no. Alan, don't think that. The practice is doing the practice. So let me go to the other reading that we did today, and then we will go into our Dharma dialogue. And this was The Misunderstanding of Many Lifetimes by Hongzhi. Emptiness is without characteristics. Illumination has no emotional afflictions. With piercing, quietly profound radiance, it mysteriously eliminates all disgrace. Thus, one can know oneself. Thus, the self is completed. We all have the clear, wondrously bright field from the beginning. So we don't need to work at this. We don't need to make ourselves special. We don't need to finally be doing Zazen. We don't need to pass all the koans. We had all this from the beginning. So now we will have a Dharma dialogue together, and I want to remind you that this is being recorded, and so if it would make you more comfortable before you speak to have the recording paused, we will do that. And before we begin the dialogue, let's all go around and just say our names. I'm Alan.
Esther.
Jenny.
Judith.
Ray.
Carol.
Susan, Aaron,
Melissa.
So please come forward with whatever's coming up for you, whether it seems to be related to the Dharma talk or it's just coming up.
I love what you said about your story. It's so powerful. Srimad Sukhavati and the young woman who thought she had made some progress. I'm so proud of any progress. practice is giving credit to practice and not, nothing is so counterintuitive. Mm. You know, to the way that we live our lives. I appreciate the reminder.
Yeah, and so how do we walk that line between building ourselves up and beating ourselves up? You know, and sometimes in Zen teachings we encounter this image of walking a knife edge. And if you've ever walked on a knife edge ridge, you know it's really scary because if you trip and fall to the left, you fall 1,000 feet. But if you trip and fall to the right, then you fall 1,500 feet. And so you go very slowly. And yet you can't go too slowly. You can't try to trick it, because then you'll seize up and you will fall. And so here we are on this knife edge. And we just have to feel a certain... Peter Matheson talks about this quite literally in The Snow Leopard, about walking on ridges where... You know, he would fall a couple thousand feet. And having grown up in the Northwest, you know, mountaineering and backpacking in the mountains, I've been in that situation. And you really, you have to be loose. You have to trust your feet. And you almost have to drop your mind into your feet and just know, I've been walking for years. My feet know what to do. You know, there's this much room to walk on. That's all my feet need. And so this is what we do in our practice. We just, you know, we walk the knife edge. We try not to lean towards despair. We try not to lean towards presumption. And we walk the path.
Well, and it's really important to know that turning that upside down, we will fall on either side. And that's it too. Because we sometimes get the idea that we have to behave in a certain way, we have to practice in a certain way. So if you come in to Dokusan and you're just full of yourself because, yeah, it's hard to imagine, that I have really achieved this thing, or I really have this insight into a koan, or, you know, I'm calm and nothing will ever perturb me. That's not a mistake or a problem. Right? That's also the practice. And to really feel what it's like to be full of that that sense of, I'm just like, I have done something. And falling the other way is also really important, because many of us will come in and, you know, just feel horrible about ourselves. And I've been working on the same koan for hours or weeks or months. And, you know, and I think my first teacher didn't pass me on my first koan for 9 years. It's just the style that he was raised in. Yeah, we're much nicer here. You know, we let you go after a few months. But that's important too. That despair that arises is also the Dharma. So it's not that, you know, one or the other, and you have to maintain that balance. Even maintaining the balance, that's it too. And not maintaining the balance, that's it too. So once we realize that, we think, I'm going to fall, I'm going to die 1,000 feet, 1,500 feet. Apparently it doesn't happen that way. It does on the trail. All metaphors fall apart. But it doesn't in Zen. It does if you fall in love with either side. I am the worst person on the planet. Or, I am really a person of Zen now. And all through the Tonglen slogans, they keep warning us about both sides. It's really kind of wonderful. Just like Alan was pointing out, these two are a pair. You know, they fit each other that way. Because that's how the human mind works, isn't it? Yeah. Thank you.
that gets me to the question of why do we practice? Why do I practice? And, you know, I think you answered it. It's practice doing practice, but somehow that's not satisfying to me. So,
well, so why do you come back?
I don't have a clue. It just seems to be the right thing to do. Yeah. That's all I know. Yeah, yeah. And I know when I go home, the world seems a little brighter, yeah, a little more in focus, yeah, that sort of thing. And I say, after 3 months, it's like, I can do this again.
Yeah.
And I just do it.
Yeah. Well, and it feels like that's a little bit like Alan was talking about trusting your feet.
Uh-huh.
Right? Because none of us know what we're doing here. Right. If you think you know what you're doing here, you are really deluded. Right. But there is something that you see, that you experience, that calls you back and says, you know, I don't understand this, but it's true or authentic or moves me closer to life.
Yes.
And it is weird and wild and frustrating and wonderful and terrible, right? And let me take another bite of this sandwich, right?
And you know, my mind goes to a couple places with this that are even different. You know, and so you'll hear these things, these answers seem contradictory, but they're actually all pointing in very similar directions. So, who is the guy who says we have secret practices? The guy
Barry Magic,
right. So it's the idea of the secret practice is we hear all these teachings and, yeah, I'm just here to sit. But really, that's not true. I really have a secret wish to be a better person. And so I'm gonna do so. I know my teachers keep saying that's not it, but I do. That's why I come. And everyone here has the secret practice, actually many secret practices. So the secret practice is also part of the Buddha Dharma. It's okay to want to make this into a self-improvement project and to be in that delusion until it wears itself out. That's very important. If you just try to talk yourself out of it, it's unbelievable. Why would I schedule time on a Saturday morning in January to sit here when I could be, you know, doing some other stuff, right? That just doesn't make sense. So the delusion is very important. Mm-hmm. So to really, you know, when David asked you, why do you really want to be here? And of course you don't know. Mm-hmm. But then there's, keep asking that. There's another koan, the world is vast and wide. Why do you put on your 7-piece robe, mm-hmm, at the sound of the bell? It's pointing in this direction. You know, is there a way to know why we're doing things? And ultimately, those delusive ideas about what we think we want do drop away, but you can't throw them away because they'll keep coming back. You know, really, after all these decades, I still think, I'm not practicing right because otherwise I'd be a different person. You know, I'd be taller. Or whatever. You hear how crazy that is? I'm a really bad Zen practitioner. Right? Or I wouldn't get old, or I wouldn't get sick. I must be making a mistake somehow. So this big, big, spacious, loving presence for not knowing, and also for the secret stuff you don't want to share with anybody. If you want to be calm from practicing Zazen, excellent. You know, the calmness is a side effect. It really is. We do get calmer. You want to be more loving? That happens. More wise? That happens. But ultimately, this is about waking up. And I think that, what did you call it? Everything's a little brighter.
Yeah.
I think when we start waking up, and going back to Alan's wonderful Shinryu Suzuki story, you know, that Zazen is doing Zazen, we start to realize that the Dharma is doing us. And it's so, and then we feel our feet on the ridge, you know, then things aren't so hard for us. And then you know what happens once we taste that a little bit? We go, oh, this is it, I did it. Check. Can you feel how subtle it is?
Yep.
Yeah. So it's great to keep asking. And then keep doing. Wonderful.
It's kind of a different track, but when you were talking about interdependence. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I was thinking of Thoreau, Walden, again. And I really loved that book. But then years later, I tried to listen to the audiobook, and he sounded really preachy and arrogant. And when you were talking about the interdependence, I was thinking, like you want to say, oh yeah, where'd you get the hammer? I guess that relates to the don't eat poisonous, that I did it.
Right. By the way, I forgot to invite everyone to sit comfortably, so if you wish to. Some of you just found your way there. Yeah, well, I don't know if you want me to talk about Thoreau or not, because now you've tempted the English professor out of me.
How about interdependence?
but here's how I want to use one to get into the other. Yes, parts of it are preachy, and let's face it, he came from this New England tradition of Puritan preachers, and wasn't that far removed from them, and Emerson was the same. That whole group could go there, and probably saw themselves in the pulpit a lot of the time. But he was also the person who said that he went to the woods because he didn't want to come to die, thinking that he had never lived. And part of how he decided he would explore what it really was to live was that he would minimize the distance between him and his environment at Walden Pond. And so one of my favorite passages in Walden Pond is where he decides that he really wants to know what ice is. And the pond has iced over. And he gets down on his belly, you know, and flattens himself. And is apparently on the ice for hours. And he's looking at all the bubbles that are trapped in it and different patterns they have. And he listens to the ice as it moves. And he goes under different conditions. Sometimes the bubbles are this way, sometimes that way. And so this willingness to get prone, this willingness to give up, you know, the erect posture that makes us feel like we're not animals and that we're, you know, somehow, you know, little beacons of humanity in the environment, and now just flatten out. And it's like, you know, one of my teachers here, I can't even remember which one now, recently told this story about Ling Zhao, Layman Pang's daughter, leaping head first into the mud because he had fallen in the mud, and he said, "What are you doing? I'm helping you." You know, so this same gesture, just flat out down in the mud, and so if the erect posture is what we think separates us from the earth, I admire these figures who are willing to just flop down.
Well, and also appreciating tying this back to what Melissa and Bill were saying of the wrong motivation is not the wrong motivation. So I think Thoreau was an arrogant SOB, right, who really thought he was going to do it what nobody had done before. And so he was willing to throw himself into it. And all of our motivation is tinged with self-interest. There is no position of pure practice. It just doesn't exist. So we work with whatever we have, and trust that if there's something that's important for you to do, it does come from your arrogance. And then you step into it and the world teaches you. You will go face down on the ice. Whether you think it's a good idea or not. But stepping out onto the pond is sometimes required. And it doesn't matter how we get there. No pure intention, no impure intention. All of this karma is what leads us to waking up. This is not hope we escape from the bad karma, but this is the thing itself.
Mm-hmm.
maybe just one more thing if we don't have any more questions or comments. That Pema Chodron's, her first book on the Lojong teachings, which I think is in the parlor, Start Where You Are. Mm. So that's all we can do. And the other side of that is that we're being carried by great forces, the forces of bodhicitta. Mm-hmm. And to learn how to trust and align with that is another thing that we're doing here, that we are not in charge of our own practice, but we can contribute to it by making decisions. I am going to sit upright and unmoving every day and be with my life. I am going to travel from as far away as the UK and Haiti and Pittsburgh, for goodness sake, to come to a retreat. You know, there is something that we don't do it, but we engage with it. You know, and so we are an important part of the thing, but we're not in charge of the universe. At least that's what I've discovered. I might be wrong. And if so, that would be cool. And then it's not going to snow this afternoon.
And if Melissa is in charge of the universe, you've got to say she's an underachiever.
Exactly.
Sorry, Woody Allen joke. There's time for one more question, if someone has one. Mark?
I need a little bit more clarification on the slogan about not poisoning yourself. Mm-hmm. Is that food related, or is that, you know, is there something else underneath?
Yeah, it's just the metaphor again, right? So our practice should be nourishing us. Don't turn it into poisonous food. Don't make our practice something that aggrandizes us, or that you know feeds our tendency to want to be special, to want to raise ourselves up above others. And again, you know, the practice for me is about being liberated from the constraints of illusory selfhood, and it's a way of liberation, and so don't use it to fasten those chains on tighter. I think that's what it means.
Yeah, and I think also everything we take in has an impact on us, and we all know there's some things we ingest in the media, in you know, food and behavior that actually harm us. And so for me, it's bringing awareness to, so this activity, will it nourish me? And to look at that, not so much from a moral stance, but just to be conscious. You know, what is it that will nourish me now? And help move me in the direction I want to go. I think there's something about what am I trying to accomplish? Well, just zoning out. I just don't want to feel anything. No? So sometimes that is our purpose. Though, yeah, have at it. And then when we remember some deeper purpose, then it is about, for me, encouraging us to align our actions with what our deepest longing is.
I was exposed a little bit to the Lojong teachings, and that one always stuck with me in terms of my being poisonous. But for me, it's it's something I've sort of thought. I mean, I don't watch a lot of TV, and I actually don't go to a lot of movies because there's so much gratuitous violence and so forth. It's like there's enough in the world. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's not avoiding it either. Mm-hmm. But it's, you are what you consume, you know. And so that's something that had stuck with me. Because mm-hmm. just this why.
Yeah.
Expose yourself to that, to the fake stuff. Because there's plenty of the real stuff in the world. So.
Yeah, thank you.
And just there's another aspect to this. You know, Mark brought this in. Is the meaning, you know, about food related, or is it poison related in this more general sense? And there's also a teaching about transmuting poison. Right? So that's not that slogan, but that it, again, in the level of the Buddha Dharma, everything is this awakened nature with absolutely no exceptions. So that means that television and movies, everything is it. And, you know, and so if you approach everything, there's a sort of capacity that can grow in us to see things from a much more spacious angle. And I know, you know, one of my main practices is watching television. no longer on a TV screen, you know, that now everything's streaming, but it's the same practice. And I always remember this experience that I had, which some of you have probably heard me talk about before. I was watching, this was probably 20 years ago, because there used to be this streaming platform, they're called video cassettes. I don't know if you remember, where you put them in and they word in a machine. And I was watching a video cassette of the movie Speed. And the first scene of the movie is horribly scary. And, you know, if I had been smart, I would have stopped it. Because my heart was, it was making me anxious. It was like people were going to die in a horrible way, and you knew that. And it was just, they were setting it up. And so I actually did stop it. But, you know, when you stop a video cassette, there's these after images, and you can still see something, but it's wavering a little bit. And I just did Zazen for a little bit in front of the TV screen, and suddenly everything got bigger. It was like, oh, this is a piece of tape in a machine that's projecting something to me, and these are actors. And just outside of the visual camera range are people with cameras and their sets, and they don't actually continue. And these people aren't going to die, you know. This terrible thing that's going to happen. It was like one of these big revelatory moments. And so that there's a way of practicing that was so important for me. I still can't stand I can't stand watching football, for example, because it's real violence or news report. But these pretend stories, there's some way that I can watch that. And so there is a possibility for transmuting the poison. So the metaphor that's used is the peacock eats poison, and the feathers of the peacock are beautifully colored from the poisonous substance. So there's a way to expose ourselves, but don't go crazy, not as an idea, you know. So if you're upset by something, do what Rick does, just turn it off or avoid it. But there's also a certain point where you could do a little exposure therapy, just a little bit from the realm of practice. One of Thich Nhat Hanh's primary students, whose name when I knew her was Sister Fong, which is a Sister Chan Song, something like that, she did this newspaper practice where she would sit in front of the newspaper and read a headline and then put the newspaper down and just feel what was going on in the headline. And if she could bear it, she would read the article. But if she couldn't, she'd go to another headline. And this way she was training herself to not make the world into poison or non-poison, but just like this. Yeah. So lots of ways into this. Thank you both for contributing to that discussion.
So we'll sit for a few moments.